Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you and thank you for coming along. I'm Michael Green, the clerk of Green's List. I'm sure you're all here this morning because you want to hear about recovery of legal costs, not because you need the point at this late stage in the year. A little bit about the points. I had a look at the paper the Institute puts out on the various topics. What Peter Lovell is speaking on this morning, recovery of legal costs, comes under practice management and business skills. I think at that point, looking at the Institute handout, things to do with costs, cost disclosure, cost agreements, billing, negotiating fees, cost reviews, etc., they put under practice management and business skills. So I would have thought that's the appropriate point this morning. Now, to introduce Peter, he's a very experienced practitioner. You would never know that from the look of him, of course. He's had over 30 years in a commercial practice as a solicitor and as a barrister. In the cost area, Peter regularly appears before the costs court and also at VCAT in the area of costs, and so he is a person with a great deal of expertise in the area. So please welcome Peter Lovell.
Thank you, Michael. I'm aiming by 8 o'clock to cover at least the first four pages of this handout, maybe the top of page five. As the title suggests, it's recovery of legal costs in Victoria. So it basically has a Victorian component, but if you are practising in family law or do a lot of federal court work and you have bills of costs in those jurisdictions, a lot of this will apply in any event, which I'll explain when we get to the costs court aspect. You'll see this is set out in slide format. So if you go horizontally from left to right down the page, that's the overall format. You'll see there, there's an overview of what this paper covers. It's fairly self-explanatory, cost legislation, rules, disclosure agreements, assessments, etc. I've set out there for your convenience the Victorian cost legislation, which is the Legal Profession Act, obviously. And as I've said there, especially part 3.4, the old Legal Practice Act 1996 still does apply as long as the relevant retainer was entered into between you and the client prior to December 2005. Obviously, it's becoming more rare, but it still arises. So if you have a long-winded matter and you finish up having a cost dispute, I hope you don't, that act may still apply. I've also referred to the Supreme Court Act, and I've referred to various Supreme Court, County Court, and Magistrates Court rules. And of course, most of you would know the Supreme Court Practice Note number 4 of 2011, which focuses precisely on what the cost court does and how it wants things to be done. Okay. Locating embodied key concepts, they're the key concepts in the Act itself. And as most of you may be aware, you have an obligation to disclose costs. There's also a reference in the Act to the basis or bases of costs, cost agreements, bills of costs, and how they are to be reviewed. So they're in divisions 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, all very straightforward in this paper, not straightforward in the Act. Read the Act very carefully. The application of the Act hits you the minute the client comes in the door and starts talking to you about the matter. Or if the client rings you up on the telephone and says, look, I need some help, etc., or come in half an hour's time and we'll have an urgent conference, that's when the operation of the Act hits you. So you better start thinking, unlike some solicitors, start thinking about cost disclosure and cost agreements, if that's the way you prefer to go. Especially start thinking about cost disclosure because that, as I said, impacts on you immediately. And if you do not disclose estimates of costs, etc., fingers will be chopped off. So I've set out at page 2 the difference, the obvious, I thought it was an obvious difference between cost disclosure and cost agreements, but from my experience it's not necessarily seen that way in the profession. I've set out what I thought were some of the obvious distinctions between your obligation to disclose costs and your preference, possibly your own preference, to enter into a costs agreement. You don't have to enter into a costs agreement, that's up to you, but you do have to give a disclosure of costs and estimates of costs and so on, because the Act tells you to. So I've set out there in those tiny boxes which will test your eyesight, the differences between disclosure and costs agreements and with whom you make those, or you're obliged to make those disclosure obligations, etc. So I won't read through them because of time, but they are fairly self-explanatory, I believe. But as to content, you'll see there in the box in the middle on the left, halfway down, you'll see content of disclosure. And I've got there, see list of 20 items, there's about 20 items, there could be 21. In the Act, and I've referred to the relevant sections of the Act, 3.4.9 and so on. Go through those sections if you haven't already done so and see what they say, because you'll find that there's quite a bit that you actually do have to disclose to your client, and that is mandatory. Whereas on the other hand, as to content of your cost agreement, which is your optional choice, that's just like any other contract. You can put in whatever you like, as long as it's not unreasonable, and as long as it doesn't conflict with any provision of the Act or any disclosure obligations, and that gives you an opportunity to charge a rate which may be higher than a court scale, it may be higher than the PRO and so on and so forth. That's if you wish to charge a higher rate on that basis or have charges calculated in a different way. Sometimes you can have a cost agreement, for instance, which adopts part scale and part your choice of rate. So that's a matter for you. One thing about cost disclosure is that you must keep doing it. Do not make the mistake at the outset of a retainer of disclosing your estimate of costs in a particular matter of being, say, $5,000, and then 18 months later, when the matter has gone all over the place to the moon and back, you send the client a bill for $75,827. There will be a lot of problems if you do that, one way or the other. First of all, the client will complain, and we'll come to that in a minute. And you'll eventually be hauled before the cost court, one would assume, if you haven't already been dobbed into the LSC on the way. And your bill will be taxed down to an unbelievable amount, which you will in fact wonder if it's the same matter that you worked on. So we'll come to that in a minute. Down the bottom of page 2 on the left, similarities between cost agreement and disclosure statements. They do often contain a lot of the same information, but just be aware that a cost agreement is a contractual document. As I said before, your disclosure statement is your mandatory obligation to give the client a feel for what the client's going to be up for. You do not have to have them in a separate agreement, but it is strongly recommended that they be separate agreements. I strongly recommend that. The reason being, unless your single document, if that's the way you insist on going, is very carefully worded, it will generally be interpreted or construed by the cost judge of the cost court to be a cost disclosure agreement only, and not a cost disclosure statement only, and not a cost agreement. Also, with a cost agreement, you will invariably have it signed by the client or the third party payer, whereas a cost disclosure statement does not have to be signed as such, but it's prudent if you can get a signature on that statement, because I find that most angry, former, aggrieved, frustrated clients that haven't signed a disclosure statement say they never got it. So do not assume things will go according to Hoyle. Okay, page 3. Just a few points. The Act differentiates between clients and third-party payers. I've had a few situations where the third party, or the person paying the bill, has not been the client for all sorts of reasons. You are still obliged to make disclosure to those individuals. Disclosure estimates. I've said there that it may be difficult to make a close estimate. You're not meant to make a precise statement. Obviously, that would be impossible. We're always asked to predict the future by the clients. Here, the Act, well, the politicians are asking us to predict the future, but at least try and be as carefully calculated as possible. And as I said earlier, keep your cost estimates and disclosure requirements up to date. It may be that you can send a letter to the client every 3 or 4 months saying, okay, since we last did this, that and the other, you now require me to go to court, you now require an urgent injunction, we're going to have to brief seven QCs. Now the cost estimates will be X. And we have also got cost estimates from each QC, and here are copies of them. Don't overlook that type of thing, because that's where most of the problems arise, by not continuing with ongoing disclosure estimates, etc. I've said here in one of the middle boxes, a common fear is if an estimate is too high, it will turn the client away. From my experience, turn the client away. Rather than try and understate your estimate to keep the client. You can break your estimates up into stages. You have to update them, as I've said. Don't assume that your ongoing interim bills is somehow alerting the client to estimated costs. Even if a client has paid those interim bills from time to time, I've had numerous situations where we've finished up in the cost court where the client says, I only got an estimate of costs on day one. It said it was $5,000. I've now paid 17 interim bills. I've discovered I've paid nearly $200,000 in costs. I want everything taxed. And they succeed. So do not assume that just sending interim bills is some form of update of estimates. It's not. And the cost judge, might I say, gets infuriated by that situation. You will have no sympathy in the cost court at all. Disclosure when settling litigation matters, that's the middle box on the right. I just merely point that out, that those of you that do a lot of litigation will be aware of that section, where you must, in effect, give the client an indication of what's going to finish up in the client's hip pocket if you are going to settle at mediation or whenever. So you'll need to be very careful about that. Don't forget to factor in the work in progress you haven't yet billed to the client. Don't forget to factor in counsel fees that may be about to come out of the woodwork. Don't forget to factor in disbursements that you may still need to pay. When doing that, working out those estimates explaining to the client what the client will finish up in the hip pocket after settlement. Briefing counsel. Members of the bar are obliged to provide estimates of counsel fees in a similar sort of way. Because we're not providing estimates directly to the client, we have less information to pass on, thankfully, for us. But we are nevertheless obliged to pass on certain amount of information to you so that you can then on forward it to the client as part of your fee disclosure requirements or cost disclosure requirements. So we're obliged to let you have details in writing of our hourly rates, our daily rates, our estimates of what we think a trial will take or mediation or whatever period of work needs to be done or drawing court documents and so on. We're obliged to let you know how often we're going to bill, whether we'll bill at the end of a phase of a matter or at the end of a matter, whether it's no win, no fee, etc., etc., etc. So we have those obligations to pass on to you as well. Okay. Avenues for client. This is assuming disgruntled client. I've left out the word disgruntled. Your former client. For whatever reason, clients get very twitchy about legal costs. It doesn't matter, as I said before, whether they've been paid or not. Doesn't matter what you've done to soothe their jangled nerves. They like to complain about costs. Even long-standing clients will eventually reach that point. The client or former client can initiate a cost dispute with the Legal Services Commissioner. That is not a nice way to go for reasons I'll explain later. They can apply to VCAT to set aside your cost agreement, if you have a cost agreement. As I said, you don't have to have one, but if you have one, it can be set aside for various reasons. Or they can apply to the Cost Court, which is a portion or part of the Supreme Court of Victoria, for a review of legal costs. Similarly, the law practice, or you, can do or take certain steps. You can issue proceedings for unpaid costs in the relevant courts, or you can also go to the Cost Court for a review or taxation of your own costs, and I'll explain some of this later. Or you can refer it to VCAT if the client has already dragged you to the Legal Services Commissioner but doesn't want to do anything further, a case of which I already have at the moment. The client went to the LSC and then suddenly stopped but still won't pay. So the choice of forum depends on a whole range of things which I won't really bore you with. Suffice to say, try and avoid going to the LSC. Try and avoid going near the LSC. Try and avoid thinking about the LSC. Go to the Cost Court. That's my suggestion. Do not bounce the ball in the Magistrates Court or the County Court or the Supreme Court by issuing a complaint or a writ saying naughty client owes me $10,000 in legal costs, because for all sorts of reasons you will finish up in the Cost Court so that your court proceeding, that's a Magistrates Court etc. proceeding, will eventually have to be dismissed or stayed until the Cost Court gets its hands on your file and the bill, etc. Because of time, I don't want to bore you with all the details of how that can be awkward, but just think about which direction you want to go. Often it's out of your control. Sometimes a client will report you to the LSC in any event, so you're already on the LSC pathway. And once you're on the LSC pathway, you're going to finish up on the VCAT road. And the VCAT road's not a particularly good place to be either, for reasons of user friendliness, in my opinion. But it's best overall, in my opinion, to try and get someone to take you to the Cost Court or take yourself to the Cost Court. And I'll explain that later on in part two of the paper. So complaints to the Legal Services Commissioner, I've already addressed that. That's form filling, etc. And as I said, that's usually undertaken by the client. Types of complaints. Well, any dispute relating to legal costs of less than $25,000 is a civil dispute. So if the brawl is about legal costs exceeding $25,000, you don't really have to worry too much about the LSC anyway, so far as a cost complaint is concerned, as long as the client is not also going to make a complaint about your misconduct. And your misconduct may be the very fact that you've not provided a cost disclosure statement at the outset. I haven't set out in this paper all the pros and cons and intricacies of a disciplinary complaint. That's really a topic for another time. But I just mention it to you. Who may make a cost complaint? Well, as it's already evident, it will emanate from the former client or the third party payer. It can also emanate from beneficiaries under a will, or basically anyone that's going to be out of pocket one way or another because of your legal costs and so on. So I've set out at the bottom of page 4 on the right some of the relevant provisions about making a cost complaint, and this really involves the LSC. I've just set out the relevant parts of the Act. I'll leave that for you to cogitate over in your own time. But the top two boxes at the top of page 5 really explain what those provisions mean in a very brief manner. That if the client takes you to the LSC, there is an obligation on the client to have to pay up the monies in dispute, the monies owing to the LSC. You might think, oh, well, that's pretty good. At least it's forced the money out of their pocket to the LSC. And then you'll go through a mediation process and so on and so forth. And if it's resolved, the money just gets tipped into your pocket. The problem is, if it doesn't get resolved, the money stays with the LSC, or worse, the LSC will, in some instances, forgive the client from having to pay any money at all. In other words, waive that obligation, because, of course, your former client is someone that's probably seemingly impecunious. They will come up with all sorts of stories for the LSC to look upon them favourably in not making the former client pay any money in dispute in advance to the LSC. The LSC can be quite forgiving in that regard. Whether that's good, bad or indifferent, I'm not making a comment. So there's a non-binding process. The LSC will try and mediate the situation. If it goes nowhere, as it often does, then all roads lead to VCAT. You cannot jump ship at that point and go to the cost court. You are stuck on the VCAT road to the end. In that top right-hand box at page 5, where I'm going to stop, you'll see there that there's a reference here to the legal practice list. So there are members that sit at VCAT and senior members that sit at VCAT in the legal practice list that will, in a sense, conduct a taxation of costs or a review of costs. When I say taxation, I mean like an assessment of costs. And you might think, well, gee, that's okay, that's pretty good. The same sort of thing happens in the cost court. The only trouble is that will be conducted from the witness box. So you will be standing in a witness box for most of the day with boxes of files around your feet, pulling out pieces of your file, and under oath trying to explain what you did and what you didn't do and why certain items in your bill should be allowed. And that is if there is a bill. There may not in fact be an itemised bill by which your costs are being taxed, because VCAT does not always order the delivery of an itemised bill. So you will be flummoxing around in the witness box with paper everywhere, trying to explain to a member who has no idea of what the substantive proceeding was ever about, why you did certain work. And consequently, the member will make a determination at the end of your one-day hearing or four-day hearing, as the case may be, as to what the likely feel of the costs would be. So you may not be satisfied with the end result, in my opinion. So I'm happy to conclude the first session at this point. We've got about 2 minutes. I'd prefer to take questions at the end, but if anyone has one question now, I'm happy to answer it. Otherwise, we can have a break.
Just a brief question on disclosure. If payer is separate to the client, do you
disclose?
Do you have to disclose both to the client and the payer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. That was a quick question.
Maybe repeat the thing at the back.
Oh, the question was if you're dealing with a client and a third party payer, whether you need to disclose to both, and the answer is yes. That's cost disclosure of costs to both by way of your cost disclosure statement. Your mandatory cost disclosure statement, failing which, as I said, fingers will be chopped off.